Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Inspiration, Imagination, and Invention Show with Simon Rose at BTR's World of Ink Network. Be prepared to call in later and chat with Simon Rose and his guest, John Wilson, right here at BTR's World of Ink Network, the Inspiration, Imagination, and Invention Show. Your host today is Simon Rose, the author of science fiction and fantasy novels for middle grade readers. He also has written a number of nonfiction titles for children and offers authors in residency programs. It's 9 p.m. Eastern Time on July 6th. As always, you can listen to any of our shows here on the World of Ink Network at blogtalkradio.com, World of Ink Network, or you can listen to us on demand at the same link or on iTunes, just search for World of Ink Network. We'll be taking your calls, as I said, toward the end of the show. If you'd like to call with a question, this call-in number is 714-242-5259. Again, that's 714-242-5259, and the chat room is also open. Well, good evening, Simon. It's nice to be here again tonight.
Yes, good evening, Virginia. It's an honor and a pleasure, of course, to be here as usual. I suppose I should tell all our listeners about our wonderful guest.
Yes, that's your job.
Not mine. Yes, I will. Well, our guest this month is John Wilson. He's a I suppose he's going to tell us all about himself, of course, but he's a Canadian author, but originally from Scotland. He's the author of over 30 novels and non-fiction books for children, teens, and adults. A lot of them are historically based, which is one of the reasons why we've invited him to share his thoughts and everything on the show here. His passion for the past and for creating stories has taken him to Roman Germany, Renaissance London, a Civil War prison camp, New Mexico and Arizona in the 1870s, and much, much more. Although he goes through all over the historical spectrum with his books and everything, his main interest is in the First and Second World Wars, which are the setting for quite a few of his titles. John, of course, as all of us do these days, he has a presence online, and you can find out more about John Wilson and his books at johnwilson-author.blogspot.com. So, Mr. Wilson, how are you this evening?
I'm doing very well, Mr. Rose. How are you?
Well, not too bad. Not too, very formal, of course, but that's what we're like on the other side of the world, of course. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, it's another beautiful day here in paradise.
Yes, whereabouts? Now, you're. I know a bit more about you, of course, than our listeners will, of course. But you are in Canada, I believe. You're on the Pacific coast of Canada, aren't you?
On Vancouver Island, yeah.
But you're not from Canada, are you? Not originally.
Well, originally I was. I was born and spent my troubled youth in Scotland in the 50s and the 60s, and traveled around. I lived in Zimbabwe for a couple of years, and then I used to be a geologist before I took up writing full time, and so I came to Canada, and Calgary was the place to be at that time in the 70s. I worked there for 10, 12 years, Calgary and Edmonton, and then took up writing and moved out to the coast here.
So how long have you been writing exactly?
I started writing full time in 1989, but not books for kids. I started off as a freelancer, writing historical articles, popular science articles, travel articles, that sort of thing, selling photography that I'd taken while I was traveling for in-flight magazines and so on, and then gradually over the years it morphed into. As I had kids and as the kids grew up, I started writing stories for kids' magazine.
Were you actually writing things when you were the stuff you started out with then? You were doing that when you were still a geologist, I guess.
No, the first it was a midlife crisis, I guess. I wrote a couple of articles after my wife and I in the mid 80s took. A year off and traveled around the world, backpacked around the world, And, you know, that spoils you for a lot of things. And
yes,
one of the things it spoils you for is going back to a government job in Edmonton in the winter. So I was looking around for other things to do, and I sold a couple of articles to in-flight magazines and newspapers and thought, well, you know, I'll give this a try. So I did that for a couple of years and then realized that, you know, that I could make a living doing this, and that the other thing was I didn't need to live in Edmonton in the prairies in top of the prairie winters. So, you know, if I was going to starve as a writer, I could just as easily do it out here on the West Coast where the weather's nice. So,
so nothing to do with children's books whatsoever at first then, but then having children, was that what sort of got you into writing books? Because I suppose, I must admit, when I was, when I was working in the real world, I was doing all sorts of bits and pieces of writing. I think I mentioned it on the last show, or probably the first one I did here, was people used to say, well, you're good at writing, you can write this press release, this fax, this sales letter or whatever. So I got sort of lumbered with all this stuff in the office. And then, again, I suppose similar to probably to you, I had kids, and suddenly I started looking at kids' books again for the first time in many years and thinking, well, this is fantastic. I wish I could write this. Or, alternatively, this is terrible. Couldn't I do better? So was it much the same
better
for you?
It was similar. I mean, you know, when I go into schools, a question I always get asked is, you know, have you always wanted to be a writer, you know, from, you know, this is from grade 8, 9, and so forth, right? Because in schools today, at least in North America, kids are encouraged to write creatively, right? I mean, I did a lot of writing in school, but back then in Scotland, it was, you know, essays, an essay on the Romans in Britain or Henry VIII's wife,
yes,
or something,
yes,
like that, right? So we weren't encouraged to write creatively, and authors never came into schools, so it never crossed my mind that I could ever be an author or even a writer. But I tell the kids I have always been an author, because for as long as I can remember, I'd lie in bed at night and make up stories based on something I'd seen on television, or a movie I'd seen, or a book I was reading, or a story that my father had told me in one case. And I would make up stories. I would imagine myself as a character in one of these stories that had attracted my attention. And I never wrote any of them down. I can't remember any of them. But that's all I do now. So I think
about a very active imagination back then. I mean, that obviously helps.
You obviously have the right sort of thought processes for it.
Yeah.
It was a very long and roundabout route to get to the stage of actually writing these things down, right? But the impetus has always been there, I think, you know, even when I didn't realize it.
Yeah, actually, I've attracted the attention of my publisher with a story that I had the idea for about 10 years ago, and he's finally taken an interest in it. And I found myself digging out a box from my cupboard here, which I'm looking at right now, which is called my ideas file, which is from about the year 2000, when I started writing things down. It's got newspaper clippings in there and things. There's some fascinating stuff in there that I've never looked at for years, and so it might come in useful. So now, you though, one thing I did want to ask, because we're looking at historical fiction on this show, not exclusively, because we're interested in hearing about other things too, but you have books, all your books aren't historical though, are they? I mean, you've got some that aren't
They are all historical, because the ideas for all of them, the impetus for all of them, comes from the history. So I have my first three books were a trilogy of time travel fantasy about dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. I've seen that one, and I've been at the Young Writers Conferences and things. Yes.
Yeah, it was Wheat, and then Wheat's Quest, and Wheat Alone.
But it's still historical. The dinosaurs are part
of
history.
I mean,
you're
just going back 65 million years instead of 200, 2000. You know, so it's still the past broadly.
So it sounds like you've always been interested in history. Then, I mean, now my degree at university was in history. I was probably intending to be a history teacher at one point, but that never materialized. But I mean, I've always been interested in history, and I guess you have as well. But is that because you're from a place like I am, that's where there is a lot of historical stuff to look at, or is that not a factor?
I don't know. I was wondering about that, because I knew you were going to ask that question sooner or later.
Good.
I thought, what was it that got me interested in history? And as far as I can remember, I have always been interested in history. I can't remember a time that I wasn't. And I think, I mean, I can come up with lots of reasons and lots of rationalizations, but that's what they are, rationalizations. And I think part of it, at least, is... my parents, I was born relatively late in their lives, and they lived most of their lives in India as part of the British Raj, the British Empire, don't you know, and all that kind of thing.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I grew up with parents who, one, were older than the parents of most of my friends, and who had lived this completely different life in the 20s and the 30s. You know, tiger hunting, all this kind of stuff. That's what my dad used to do.
Wow.
You know? And so I always had this sense of something lost, you know, because them coming back to Scotland, it must have been hell for them. They lived in India, and they were imperialists and all the rest of it. They lived a good life because they were the rulers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So coming back to Scotland must have been really tough for them. And my mum particularly was always saying, oh, it was such a wonderful life in India. And I grew up with that kind of sense of a lost past. And I think that's probably where it comes from. And I think that's probably also part of the reason that I'm in Canada now. Because my sisters and I all grew up with my mum saying, why would you want to live here? You know? I mean, what the underlying message was... go out into the empire, but of course there was no empire at this point. But
This is the closest there would be to the empire, I suppose. Is places like Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, Canadians get a bit upset if you call it the empire and stuff. You know. So.
And the colonies, yeah. I suppose.
We try not to.
It's interesting. It's interesting, actually, because I know that whenever if I meet people who've actually been to England, and they've been to England and they've been on holiday, of course, they haven't even been there, say, working for 6 months. They've been there on holiday for maybe a couple of weeks as part of a European tour, and they've gone in the summer when it's nice and green, and they've gone to Scotland probably as well, maybe to Ireland, and in London and York and all these other places, and of course they think, oh, why would you want to live in Canada? And, you know, and it's all that history all around you. And as I've explained to some people, I said, look, there was in the town where I grew up, there was a church that was built in 1350, and it was a massive, huge church, almost cathedral size, with a massive spire, still there, of course. And you know, I used to drive by it in a car. I used to walk by it when I was a child. I even worked quite close to it when I worked in England as well for a few years. And I didn't really pay that much attention. I never really looked up and marvelled at the majestic architecture of the medieval stonemasons and things. You know, it was just part of where you grew up, really. I mean, it's different now. I've been here for 20 years. But I don't think living in a place like that. Yeah, you take it for granted. I think in your case, it certainly sounds like that would certainly be more of a lost time that was just fascinating. Because what was it like? And I suppose that's been like that for me too with history. I don't know why. I often wonder, well, obviously these people, whether it's in Napoleon's time or back in the Middle Ages, these people were human beings like us. They weren't probably as educated sometimes. They didn't have the same technology, and maybe they couldn't read sometimes. But they were still human beings just like us. So what was it like? I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. I've always been interested in history too, you know.
Well, and if there's one thing that I try and get across when I go and talk to kids in schools and in my books, it's that regardless of the time, you know, Roman times or Middle Ages or the First World War or the Civil War, you know, for people who lived through it, we look at history and history seems simple. It seems almost as if things happened the way they should have happened because they've got us to here. And we're really important, right? So obviously this is... the right way things should have gone.
Yes,
but
it's a timeline, isn't it? Yes, it's the line.
Yeah,
yes.
But 200 years ago, if you had been alive then, it would have been just as confusing and frightening and, you know, all the rest of it as our world is today. Because you wouldn't have known what was going to happen next, right?
That's right. And, of course, there's a whole industry and websites and goodness knows what else on alternate history, of course.
Oh, the alternate histories,
I've read books on that. I have a few books on this, a couple of books called What If and things like that, when if a decision had gone wrong, or, you know, a major figure in history like Hitler or Napoleon or Julius Caesar or someone like that, if they hadn't done something at a certain time, and how would it have affected things? You know, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, obviously you've done books on lots of different time periods without sort of chit-chatting about the two world wars too much just yet, but how do you choose, do you select a time period to write about? I'm presuming, like me, you wouldn't just go down a list and think, it must be time to write about the Tudors, or it must be time to write about ancient Greece or something. No, you suddenly get interested in something and think, there's a story there.
Yeah, and it's, I read a lot of historical stuff, non-fiction and historical fiction. And, you know, I'm interested in all history, that, you know, anything that catches my attention. But the thing that's different, that triggers writing a book, is I have to have something different. I have to have something that makes me stop and think, wow, I didn't know that. Or, good grief, what would I have done in that situation? I mean, and that amount of pressure, or, you know, how would I have survived in Andersonville, a prison camp in the American Civil War, you know? How would I have done that? There has to be a wow moment, something that I think, maybe people don't know that much about this. Maybe it's an unusual fact. Maybe there's a different way to present this. And once I get
now
that...
That's an interesting way of looking at it, but in some ways, just something that came to mind here. If you've found something about the Civil War, for example, that is, I didn't know that. That's interesting. I should find out more about it. If it's too obscure, would that mean that a publisher wouldn't be interested in it because it's just too obscure? And it's like you and probably me and other enthusiasts who find it fascinating, but a publisher wouldn't be interested enough to do a book because he thinks it wouldn't sell.
The facts might be obscure, but the story doesn't have to be. I mean, like you were saying earlier on, the stories are universal, right? The problems that the characters had to put up with, have to be, whatever period you're writing about, they have to be relatable to a reader today, right? And that's the key. So the actual facts and figures and whatnot aren't really that important if you can build a story around it. I mean, I'll give you an example with Death on the River, which came out a couple of years ago. And when I was 12 or 14, I read McKinley Cantor's Andersonville, which won the Pulitzer Prize in the 50s. And it's a big book, great book, about the prison camp in Andersonville in 1864, 1865 in Georgia. And I thought that was really interesting, and I remembered a lot about it. And then 3 or 4 years ago, I was doing some reading, and I discovered the Sultana, which was a riverboat on the Mississippi River. And in 1865, the boilers blew up and the thing sank, you know, a few miles north of Memphis. Now, these two facts seemed completely unrelated until I discovered that one of the reasons the boat sank was that it was grossly overcrowded with returning prisoners of war from Andersonville.
Okay.
And they had been crammed onto this thing because the riverboat captains and corrupt Union officers were taking money to put as many bodies as possible. They were paid to get these men home. So the more they could cram onto a riverboat, the better. So the riverboat was rated for, you know, 350 people. And there was something, nobody knows for sure, but there was something over 2,000 on board. And more people died when the Sultana blew up than died when the Titanic went down.
Good heavens.
And the thing that got me interested is it seemed really unfair. Like, these guys had gone through absolute hell in Andersonville. It was just, you know, I mean, it was like it was like Belsen in the Holocaust, the concentration camps towards the end of the war. Not the deliberate murder, but the conditions that they lived in. And they'd gone through that. They'd survived the war. They'd been rescued. They were taken down to the river, and then they died when the sultana went down because of the greed and corruption of their own people.
Huh.
And that seemed to me just horribly unfair. And that was what made me think I should write a book about that. Those two things that I knew about suddenly came together, and there was the book.
That's right. There has to be a story. I mean, that's what I've tried to explain to some people, but not on shows like this before, when people say, oh, about history and having a passion for history and this sort of thing. I've said, well, yes, I have lots of favourite historical time periods. I really do. There's lots of them, really, but quite often they don't really fit. So, like the Napoleonic era, for example, is a marvellous, fascinating time. But I've struggled quite often to think, well, I would write a story that, for kids. Well, I've never really found a story that might fit that particular time period, as opposed to World War II, where I found lots of them. There has to be a story that's going to fit there. It's like the medieval time period. I didn't have that much interest in when I was growing up, but now it's a fantastic setting for kids' stories. Even though you have a favorite thing, like I mentioned, you've mentioned it, Roman Germany, of course, is another one of those areas. The whole Roman Germany thing and the barbarian invasion things are a fascinating period, and I'm not surprised that you've set a book in that time period, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That's another one of those that is prime material, really.
Yeah, it is a problem. It used to be more of a problem when I was starting out. I had an early manuscript, which was eventually published somewhere else, but I had an early manuscript turned down by a major Canadian publisher who shall remain nameless, because they said in the rejection letter it wasn't Canadian enough. Now, it was a story about a boy and his father, Canadian boy and his father, who were on holiday in Spain in 1936 and get caught up in the first chaotic week of the Spanish Civil War. And they get separated, and the story is basically about that week, about him trying to find his father and all the things that happen and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I got this letter from the publisher, and it said, you know, not Canadian enough, and I thought, oh, that's a shame. And then I stopped, and I thought, no, that's quite dangerous. Because in saying that, what's implicit in that is that I have to write only about Canadian history. And that's
and
a very,
story,
very narrow
set,
view of the world.
Set the story in Canada.
Yeah, and if I want to write about... And that means I can't write about the Spanish Civil War, because it didn't happen in Manitoba. It happened in Spain. I can't change that.
Would you be allowed to write about Canadian soldiers in World War II?
I assume so. It would have been interesting to call them up and point that out, you know?
Yeah,
but
it has to be Canadian soldiers fighting to liberate Canada from the Nazis, maybe.
Yeah, it seems easier if you are writing about the Romans, for instance, because there was no European presence in Canada in those days. So if you're writing for European historical audience, or interested audience, then you can get away with that, right? Much more easily. But then I wrote a book about Stalingrad, or set during the Battle of Stalingrad, and there are no Canadians in it, there's no Americans in it. There's a Russian soldier and there's a German soldier, and it tells their two stories and what happened to them, called Four Steps to Death. But to say that can't be published in Canada, for instance, because it's not Canadian enough, is ridiculous, because what happened in Stalingrad changed the world. And Canada and America are the places they are now. In some ways, I'm not exactly certain how, but in some ways they are the way they are now because of what happened in Stalingrad in 1942, even though there were no Canadians or Americans involved.
Well, at least they didn't ask you to throw a Canadian or an American in there, you know, just say, well, you know, why can't you just put some extra characters in there? Because that is like, what was it, one of those film directors said, why have we only got 10 disciples? Give me 100 of them. That was it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Back in the days of Hollywood, you know, I said, yes. It was probably Cecil B. DeMille or somebody like that, yeah.
Probably.
Why have we only got 10 disciples? Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing. I mean, yes, World War II is one of those things where definitely where, you know, things that happened, say, yes, all the way over in Stalingrad, over by the Caspian Sea there, long, long way from Canada, long way from Western Europe. It had tremendous effect, of course, on the world that we live in today, with, you know, with the European Union and goodness knows what else. So yeah. But you don't just do stuff about Canadian history, of course. You mentioned you've done this book, The Death on the River, which is all about, obviously, the U.S., American history. So, obviously, you've been doing stuff. Now, have these been published by Canadian publishers, the American history ones?
Yes, they're published by Orca in Victoria. Distribute throughout North America. So, it doesn't make much difference in that sense. But I've done a lot of traveling in the States, Western states particularly, and there's places down there that I love, and there are places down there that I've been thinking for years. I really want to write a book set here. Arizona, New Mexico is one. You know, I love the desert, and I just haven't been able to think of it until Written on Blood came out last year, and it's the first of a trilogy.
Is that set in Arizona in
the 1870s in Arizona Territory, New Mexico Territory, and Mexico, that whole area in there, and the things that were going on. There's a Canadian boy, but that's not particularly significant. I only have him because he goes down there and he doesn't know anything about what's happening, right? So he's a device, because he's going down there from Canada and he gets caught up in everything that's happening there at that time, and he can lead the reader through it because he hasn't a clue what's going on either, right?
It isn't the same Canadian boy that was caught up in the Spanish Civil War that's gone time traveling, is it?
No. At least I changed his name anyway, you know.
So that's Written in Blood. Written in Blood's just come out, you say, or
It came out last fall. The sequel, the second one, Ghost Moon, is ready to
Ghost
go.
Moon.
Ghost Moon. Ghost Moon.
That sounds good.
Is scheduled to come out this September. And
no,
it's not a trilogy in the sense...
October 31st. It needs to come out October 31st, doesn't it? Ghost Moon?
Ghost Moon?
Halloween
for Ghost Moon, but it's not a sequel in the sense that it continues the story. It's a completely separate story about what happens to the main character and several of the other characters in Written in Blood, a year and a half afterwards.
Right,
and then
so,
the
and
third one will come out next fall.
Now, have you written the third part as well?
The third one's written, yeah, as well.
Wow, so it's already done.
The second one, Ghost Moon, is set during the Lincoln County War in the late 1870s. So I've got Billy the Kid as a character in there. And I was down there on holiday last March for spring break, and drove around and went to Lincoln and all the museums and all the different places where there's, you know, historical stuff from that time left. So I did a lot of background stuff then. That was really interesting.
So Ghost Moon is coming out then. Yeah, that's already done, already written. And the third one is written, but is it all revised and edited and ready to roll, or have you still work to do on that one?
No, it's written. We'll do a revision of it this winter sometime, and it'll come out maybe next spring. I'm not absolutely certain whether they're going to.
How long?
Probably in the spring.
One of those questions. It sounds like one of those questions that kids always ask us when we go to schools and things, of course. And it's sorry to ask it in some ways, but I'm just curious because you seem to be quite prolific with some of these books. How long does it take you to write a book, without sounding like a grade 6 kid here, but how long does it take you, say, to write Ghost Moon? I mean, obviously, it's not a sequel.
Well, thanks, Simon. I was terrified for a moment that you were going to ask me the question that somebody asks in every single class you ever go to. Mr. Wilson, which is the favorite book of yours that you have written?
Oh, I get asked that one. Well, and also, are you rich? Are you rich, they say, too, don't they? Yeah.
Ah, that's a good one, too. Yeah. Do you know J.K. Rowling?
Yes, I should just mention to Virginia that John, Mr. Wilson and I here, Mr. John Wilson and I, we have a Young Writers Conference here in the city I live in every spring, and they have put us in rooms next door to each other for the last 3, maybe 4 years, so we always have quite a bit of fun with the students and pretend we're deadly enemies and things like that. And some of the kids get quite worried as we keep going and interrupting each other during our presentation. It was just at the beginning of our session.
Yeah.
But so how long then? How long would you say you've come up with the idea?
Okay.
You've been down to Arizona. You think I'd like to set a story here. You know it's going to be a trilogy. Perhaps you've got a vague idea. You want to write 3 books. You certainly want to write the first one, and maybe you've got an idea for half the second one. But the first one, how long will it take you to write? Are these for young adults or kids, I guess?
I'm not quite sure exactly what the definition of a young adult is, but they're for 12-year-olds.
So add
a couple of years on above and below, and that's pretty much it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take? That's a tough question to answer because under ideal circumstances, I would write something the length of Written in Blood in 6 to 8 weeks. But I never get a chance nowadays to do that, right? I'll work on it for 2 or 3 weeks and then, you know, another book will come back with editing changes. And I'll have to take a week off to do that, rewrite that, and then I'll write for another couple of weeks, and then I'll go on tour for a week or a couple of weeks, and it's a lot tougher. But at the times that I have had a straight run at something, for a YA novel, it takes me 6 to 8 weeks.
No, you are
that's
a soft writer. Go ahead, Simon. What did you say?
No, I'm just saying it's interesting what John just said, because I know that when I've been asked that before, either by adults or kids in schools, and they say, well, how long does it take you? You know, usually it's adults, actually, when you can be more forthcoming about it. They say, well, how long does it take? And I say, look, I could write one of these books that I write, which are for, the ones so far have been for 8 to 12-year-old kids, like 10, 11-year-old kids, and sometimes they're not that long. Obviously, you've got to get the idea. You know, if you've got the idea down and a plan of where it's going, I say, yeah, I could write this book in 6 to 8 weeks, a couple of months, maybe 3 months or something, because obviously I've got kids to deal with and things like that. But yeah, like John said, there's other things that come along, and sometimes it can be a year, sometimes with these books, because you've got other things going on. And it depends what you mean by writing it. Does it mean coming up with the idea in the first place until the book is actually copy-edited, which my one coming out in October is now? I haven't seen that book since the end of March, because it's in the copy edit stage and they're putting a cover on it and things. So yeah, sometimes you think, yeah, you could, if you had nothing else to do and you were uninterrupted, one of these books, yes, a couple of months, I think.
I was a demo 4 month writer. It takes me usually about 4 months to write out my novel manuscript.
I cheat though, because I don't have to make stuff up, because I use the historical background, and often that gives me a structure for the story, you know, even when I'm
looking for it. Yeah, you've got that already. You've got the facts in place. Actually, that brings me on to another subject here about research. Now, everybody always wants to know about research, but in your case, I mean, you obviously have travelled to the Southwest to do some of this, Southwest US, to look at some of this stuff, and where there are, obviously, as you say, there are historical artifacts down there, museums and all this sort of stuff, and so you can do that. But, of course, you can't travel back in time to Roman Germany or Renaissance London or even go back to the Battle of Stalingrad and things. So what about the research for things like that? What do you do? Is it all online research, or do you read books? Own books and things on these topics?
I do. Well, I do hoard books, I must admit. And history books are great for hoarding because they often end up on the remainder shelves because nobody else wants to read the 3 volumes on something obscure that I do, you know. So I can often pick up books relatively cheaply and hang on to them. I think generally, I don't start a book until I have a lot of the background in place, at least broadly, because I only write about subjects that interest me. So, like I said earlier, I've read about them quite a lot, and then I find a different angle. So, for instance, that my short at Dawn, which came out a couple of months ago, is set in the First World War. And, you know, kids say, how long did it take you to do the research for it? Well, it took me, you know, 40 years. I've been reading books on the First World War since I was a teenager, you know. So all that information is all there when I get the idea for the book. So that's one aspect of it. Another is, in a couple of cases, I've been lucky enough to get grants to go over to one I wrote, a couple of books that were set in the Arctic around the John Franklin expedition, 1845. And I went over to the Scott Polar Research Institute, National Maritime Museum over in England, and read the old letters and so forth. And I've been over to the Imperial War Museum doing research and stuff too. That doesn't happen as often as I would like it to, although often I can go somewhere as part of a holiday, perhaps, and
yes,
see the landscape where the story happened, which is important, especially if it's a battle or something like that. You know, it's, you can't beat walking over the landscape where something actually happened.
No, that's right. You've got to get a feel for it. I know that when I've been asked, in, again, mostly by adults about this research question, it's like, well, I have to explain to them. I said, I don't need to do historical research in the same sense that other people do. I don't like to say I know everything, but it's like, you know, the fact is, if somebody says, well, you've got to do all this research into the time of, you know, the end of the Wars of the Roses in England or something. I said, well, not really, because, I mean, I'm very interested in that. I've read about all this stuff, and I can picture the era quite easily in my head, and I have to do a little bit of research into clothing or what sort of books they might have had then and what the saddles were like on the horses. Little things that you wouldn't normally be interested
you
in until you write
about
a book
it, yeah,
on it. That's right, but most of the time, to picture a historical era from any time really, from the Roman era to the present day, is quite simple for me, as opposed to somebody who may sit down and think, I'm going to write a historical fiction book, a romance historical fiction book set in, I don't know, the time of Bonnie Prince Charlie or the time of Henry VIII or something, and then they've got to do all this research and read a lot of books because they're starting from scratch, which obviously you're not with the First World War.
No, so I have all that background. The interesting thing, though, is the internet makes it much, much easier for
yes,
the detailed stuff.
Yeah.
For example, the book I mentioned earlier, Four Steps to Death, about Stalingrad, the German character in that is a tank commander. So I wanted to put him inside his tank, right? And in 1942, in August, he would have been in command of a Panzer Mark IV tank. So I wanted to know what it was like inside one of those. Now, it had to be August 1942, not January 1943 or, you know, even January 1942, because they changed them, right? So to find that out in a library, traditionally, would be a very, very difficult, time-consuming task.
Yes, it would.
So I went online.
Yeah.
I went online and I discovered a bunch of guys in the Ukraine who'd found one of these things from the summer of 1942 in the bottom. It had fallen through the ice, apparently, and was sitting at the bottom of a lake. Must have been early summer or late summer. But anyhow, it was sitting at the bottom of this lake, and they dragged it out, and they cleaned it up, and they were rebuilding it. And they put pictures of it and sort of little virtual tours of the inside of this Panzer Mark IV tank from 1942 on the internet. So I just went on the internet, and there it was. There's where my character sat. There's where the gunner sat. Yeah, he could touch his shoulder. He was right beside him, you know.
That's
so,
right, because that's important.
That's
I've had that problem. I've had that sort of problem too. That the internet's been very good for that, in that you can look into things like that and decide, well, how far? Yeah, like you say, what was it like inside a tank? Is there a steering wheel? Where are the buttons? Is there a handbrake? You know, what's it look like? And where did people sit? I had this problem with the submarines. Actually, I had to look into submarines, and having never been inside a submarine, certainly not when it's in the water, it was a case of, well, how much room is there? I know it's cramped, but you know exactly how much room is there? You've got to work this stuff out. And the thing with as you said, with the different, when they change the models of the Panzers, I'm writing one right now where it's like, it's set part of it is set back in the mid-90s, and I'm wondering about, okay, I know they had cell phones in the mid-90s, but they weren't these, everyone always talks about these great big bulky cell phones people had in the past, but those were in the 80s, not the mid-90s.
Yeah.
People did have cell phones. They were still quite big, but my problem is finding out about the coverage. Could they have got coverage outside of a city in the countryside in 1994-95? I doubt it, but I can't find out for sure, but I'll get there eventually. But the research process is it's interesting stuff. You've got to get it right, as we know, because although kids don't really care that much, some reviewer reading your book or some librarian or a teacher might look at this and say, hey, that's not right. They changed that Panzer after the Battle of Stalingrad. They brought out the Mark V or whatever. Yeah.
There are a lot of people out there who don't have lives and will just zero in on anything that they think might be a mistake on the cover of a book or a detail inside or something like that. You know?
Like the Trekkies when they say he pressed the wrong button to fire the photon torpedoes in episode 26.3.
In that particular episode, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
The other thing, too, is that if you're writing for boys, they want the detail. They want the description of things in the books, right? The weapons that are being used, the vehicles that are being driven. They're much more interested than girls are in how these sorts of things worked. So you need to put a certain amount of that in.
Yeah, do you think that the war thing, the whole thing about war, obviously, you know, without stereotyping all males or all boys here, the fact is that, like action movies and explosions and goodness knows what else, I mean, there's obviously, in historical books, whether it's war or anything else, in historical fiction, there's always things were violent, and I've had to explain to people at kids at schools about, say, the time of the Tudors, so Henry VIII and executions. People were executed and things for crimes or sometimes not crimes. They were framed or the king just wanted them dead and they were executed legally at the time, of course. And people said, well, how could they do that? And the law wasn't the same. Back then it was a violent time and the justice system wasn't as developed. But and obviously you specialize to some degree in the world, the First World War and Second World War. Now, there's obviously a lot of violence in war. How do you sort of deal with that in books for 12-year-olds? I mean, obviously you have to have it. It's not as graphic or...
Well, there's a balance that you have to strike. I mean, some people have said, well, why does a book like Shot at Dawn, you know, why is it violent, set in the First World War? And, you know, my answers are always, one, I don't make any of this stuff up. You know, it's all historically accurate. All the background in my books, all the stories in my books that I weave into my story are all historically accurate. They're all researched. It was violent. And the other thing, too, is... if every war starts with a whole bunch of enthusiasm, right? The tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young men and boys as young as 14 who lining up in 1914, 1915 to go and fight in the war, right? If I write a story that's set in 1914, 1915 about a soldier going off to war, and I don't then in the second half of the book show what it's really like, then I'm glorifying war. I'm leaving the reader with a sense of the excitement and the sense of the adventure and so forth. But the soldiers became disillusioned, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and all the rest of it, although it wasn't recognized at that time. The soldiers came to realize what it was like. The reader has to as well. So it has to be in there, you know. Otherwise,
well, I know that one of my books is all about, it's based on a superhero thing, nothing to do with history, it's all superheroes and supervillains, and somebody said, well, one teacher remarked that, well, it's a little bit violent, isn't it? I said, well, it's about people blasting each other with ray guns and things and fighting, it's got to be violent, it's about superheroes didn't go around and tickle each other to death, I mean, it's just the way things are. I mean, do you think, though, that... History in general, as a theme or historical fiction, is that a good way to teach or get kids, boys anyway, enthused about reading? Because we hear this all the time about boys aren't reading and things like that because it's or they're not reading as much as they should or as much as they used to. And girls, of course, are apparently still reading, although I don't know if it's just kids in general. But do you think books about history and especially about war and fighting and things and battles, is that a good way to get boys interested in books, or are they just going to become interested in books about war?
Well, it's a touchy issue, right? I mean, people say, you know, I write for boys. Well, I don't. I write for boys and girls, but I write the books in a way that will appeal to a boy, because that's the tougher audience, right? If a girl, and, I mean, it's a generalization, and generalizations will get you every time, but generally speaking, girls will mostly finish a book and be able to tell you afterwards, girls who read a lot, will be able to tell you afterwards what was wrong with the book, right? It was boring in the middle, or that character wasn't, whatever. Boys, on the other hand, generally tend to give a book 20, 25 pages. If they don't like it, they won't finish it. They'll go do something else. And the people who turn around to me and say, well, you know, your books are too violent. Well, yeah, because history was violent, and also because I'm trying to hold these boys' attention. Because if they stop reading one of my books on page 25, they're not going to go off and read Anne of Green Gables instead. They're going to go off
really?
And play a video game.
Are you sure? Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. They're going to go off and play a video game where they can make...
Anne of Green Gables, the video game of Anne of Green Gables, perhaps, maybe.
But, yeah.
Or maybe there is...
don't get my mind working around that. But, you know, my competition is video games.
Yes.
Not
yes.
The nice little books that we would like to think all boys should read. They don't. I mean, some of them.
No, it's video games and texting and Facebook and everything else as they get older. But certainly at 12 years old, a lot of it is video games. And I think you've got to keep them. You've got to keep them interested.
Well, my greatest moment was as a writer was. 4 or 5 years ago now in Toronto, I was doing a high school in downtown Toronto, inner city school. And I did my presentation. I was talking about the Second World War. And a couple of girls came up and asked me questions afterwards. And this guy comes up, and he's grade 10. He's, you know, 6 foot. He's got the hoodie on, you know, right over the face, so you can barely see his face. And, you know, the jeans with the crotch down at the knee somewhere. Slouches over. No hello or anything, right? He comes over and looms over the table I'm sitting at and says, this is what I read. And he holds out a couple of those really violent Japanese manga comics.
Okay.
And I sort of looked at him and said, oh, cool, you know. And he said, but I read Flames of the Tiger, which is one of the books I've been talking about.
And I've read that one. That's the one I've read. That I read that one of yours, yes.
He said, I read Flames of the Tiger. He said, and I didn't know a book could be that interesting. He said, I'm going to try another one, and slouched off. And I'm sitting behind the desk going, yes, yes, because that's my audience. Everybody else
is easy. And that is a good book, Flames of the Tiger. That's the one that's set at the end of the World War II in Germany, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's told in flashback, the boy growing up in the 30s and getting drawn into the war from the German perspective.
Long before I met you in person, you famous writer, you. Yes, I'd read that book. Now, I must mention quickly, because before I forget, before we get cut off by Virginia here, but actually, we've still got a bit of time, but one thing you did want to mention, and I was interested in, you have just entered into a whole new world, haven't you, with an e-book of your... Which book's just been done? Is it the one about Franklin and the Arctic, isn't it?
Well, there are actually two now, as of today. The reason I got into this was... one of my publishers up here went bankrupt in January.
Oh, right.
It was never a pleasant
experience.
And so I eventually, after a bit of a struggle, got the rights back to several of the backlist novels. And, you know, it's tough to sell backlist to another publisher, especially in these times. So I thought, well, why not put them out myself? And I talked to various people. You, in fact, as well, back in April in Calgary.
Yes, we discussed this in April, yeah.
Doing something like this. And so I've been working on it over the last little while. There's a fairly steep learning curve to the first one, But I find the second one is much easier. And the first one was North with Franklin, The Lost Journals of James Fitzjames, which is originally it was a novel for adults, although it would be fine for grade 11, 12 as well. But a recreation of a journal of one of John Franklin's officers in 1845. The Franklin expedition was the 129 guys who went up to sail through the Northwest Passage, and every single one of them died, disappeared. And we still
another violent book from John Wilson, by the sound of things.
That's right. Well, if you look at it, you know, everybody in history's dead. So
they're not, are they?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, even Elvis. Yeah. But
that's up for debate, isn't it? Really?
Apparently it is. Yeah. But the other one, the one that I put up today on Kindle, which is the Amazon.com, and on Smashwords, which is all the other formats, is also about the First World War, called And in the Morning, from Binion's poem for the fallen that they read on Remembrance Day, Memorial Day, at the going down of the sun, and in the morning we will remember them, the dead soldiers of the First World War. So that's where the title comes from. And it's also a diary written by a boy in 1914, 15, 16, and his experiences, which goes back to what I was saying earlier, but he's all enthusiastic in 1914, and then during the course of the diary he learns what it's really like, right, over there. So that's uploaded today, and will probably be available tomorrow because it takes about 24 hours to set it up. But
and that was much easier to do, you say. The first one was a lot of work, because I mean this is something I have an interest in. I think, as we discussed when you were here, I hear a lot of people panicking about e-books and wanting to get on it right away and things. And my thought is that this thing is coming, but I'm in no rush. I'm aware of it, and I'm not scared of it. I'm not worried about it. I'm aware it's going to happen, but I'm waiting. I'll need for it's something I'm going to do later. You know, I have no problem.
Well,
last
month Amazon said that they are selling more titles on Kindle than they are hardcover books. Or paperback books, for that matter, but real books. And so I thought that's why I picked North with Franklin to do first, because it was a book for adults, and the e-book market for adults is taking off fairly rapidly.
Yes, I think it
market,
is, and that's my...
The kids' market isn't, but J.K. Rowling announced that the Harry Potter books are going out as e-books in October. You imagine what that's going to do for sales of Kindle and other e-book readers?
That's the thing. That's the thing. I've had the conversation with a few other people about e-books for the ones I do, which are 8 to 12-year-olds. I've got some of the older ones coming out soon, but I wonder how many 9 and 10-year-olds or 11-year-olds, for that matter, in elementary schools are going to be reading books electronically. I don't know yet. I may be wrong, but I don't think there are going to be as many, for example, as adults who have one of these Kindles, and they have one for for long plane journeys and things like that, or waiting at the doctor's office or something.
Kids are growing up with iPhones and Blackberries and stuff like that. They're used to reading text on a screen. I mean, my son, he's 17, but he has free texting, which is just as well, because I'd be bankrupt if he didn't. The amount of texting he gets through in a month. I once, you get the bill online, and I once checked through the bill. Didn't cost me anything, but I checked through the bill, and it was pages and pages and pages and pages of texting. Now, there's a difference, obviously, between that and reading a book, but these kids are familiar with that technology, even eight, nine-year-olds. And, the Kindles and so forth are getting cheaper now. You can get for around $100, you can get, a decent e-reader, and you can get best books. I mean, the problem is, if you go much younger than that, it's really difficult so far to put color and to put pictures in, to do a picture book or something like that.
For a novel like we do,
it would work.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what people are looking at is they're thinking, well, people expect e-books to take over from hard copy books right now, but I think it'll take a while, perhaps. But I'm not worried about it. Virginia, are we getting close to time here? Or
Yeah, we are. I just wanted to chime in really quick too with the whole ebook thing. I just had my picture book actually just go out on ebook last month on the Kindle. And what I've seen with the picture book market anyways is that mostly what it is parents have who have smartphones have different places where there's where they can set a library kind of thing so their kids can go when they're traveling and select one of the books they want off their parents kind of smartphone library kind of thing. So parents are using it that way with their younger kids, but I know not in public schools, but out in the charter schools, which are kind of like a bridge between a private school and a public school out here in the U.S., some of the charter schools, at least where I'm at in Utah, have started giving kids the iPads to put all their school books and stuff on. So kids are starting, I agree with you guys. I don't think it's going to be something that takes off as fast as it is with the adult market, but definitely your junior high and high school age kids are, I would say probably 12 and up are definitely using.
As we've said before, things are changing, of course, naturally very quickly. And if you'd have said 5 years ago, maybe in 2006, if you'd have said, "Oh, there's going to be this tablet computer, and there's going to be book sales and e-books are going to be taking over from hardcover books," by 2010, it's like people, that's only even 5 years. So by 2016, who knows what's going to be going on? I mean, there could be a massive change in technology 2 years from now. There could be something being worked on now that hasn't been released yet that's going to change the book market
The whole thing is different because, I've done the covers for both of the books that I've put up because I don't have the rights to the covers that the original books came out under.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's a completely different process because if you pick a book off a shelf, you've got a book, whatever size that book is. You can put a lot of information, a lot of detail on that. If you're scanning through Amazon or somebody, you're seeing a postage stamp.
Yeah.
So you need to have text that you can read at that size, bright colors that stand out at that size to attract people. So the philosophy behind it, behind selling books, is changing as a consequence too, because they don't look the same inside either. And if you try and make your ebook look like a real book, it won't work. It'll look messed up. It'll look clunky.
Ebook. It's a different format, and to quote the title and the cover, of a book that came out many years ago, it's A Brave New World.
A Brave New World, indeed.
Yes.
I love the idea of people reading books on their phones, and just the image of somebody reading War and Peace on an iPhone is just mind-boggling,
Watching. It's probably no different though than watching a 40-hour documentary in 10-minute chunks on YouTube.
Yeah, or Hitler used to listen to the complete works of Wagner on 78s.
Yeah.
You know how many 78s that is for the Ring cycle? I suppose he had somebody to turn the things over for him, but still.
He probably had servants or something.
Yeah, I would say we are getting to the end of the show, so I'd love John to share with us his link so our listeners can, obviously go learn more about you and hopefully pick up some of your books. I'm definitely going to push my 15-year-old son because he plays all those Call of Duty video games that are violent, so he'll like your books.
Yeah, there we go. Good. I'm in the process of building a website, but it's not up yet. I have a blog that I use as a poor man's website, which is johnwilson-author@blogspot.com. So johnwilson-author.blogspot.com. And that has links. I also have a Facebook presence and so forth and so on.
Yeah, and I'm looking. In our episode information, we also have the link to your blog, too, so our listeners can find it there as well. Well, it's been great having you on the show.
it's been fun. I've enjoyed it very much.
Yes, thanks for joining us. I mean, although it's a bit of an odd concept, an author from Calgary and an author from Vancouver Island talking to another author in Utah on the internet. But that's, as I say, it's all part of our brave new world and the new frontier.
Brave new world, yeah.
the final frontier, perhaps. Well, now we're getting into science fiction. But
yeah.
So I suppose all that's left for me to do as well is to thank you, John, for being on the show. And I'm hoping that this, you know, that people will be listening in now, of course, as well, but also listening into the recording, and that your career will be further glorified as a result of your appearance on the show.
Well, I'm sure it will with the thousands of listeners. It'd be great. Yes.
Millions,
yeah.
Millions, that's what it is.
Millions of listeners.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Now, Simon, you're taking off in August, right? No show August, if I remember correctly. From
who, me personally?
Yes. Yeah,
no, August.
Doing
is, I will be doing the show. No, I will be here for the show in August and September. It's
okay.
October when I have to go back to the old country.
The old country. Okay, so everybody needs to tune back in August to listen to Inspiration, Imagination, and Invention. I always forget that last one with Simon Rose. And then just so everybody who's listening knows. July 7th, we have a special show called What's Happening on the World of Ink Network, where we're just going to kind of cover at some of the shows that we have coming up this month and some of the changes that we have going on. And then on July 12th is a good story with Marcia Cook, and that will be a fun show. She's going to actually have a publisher, Karen Fuller, on her show. So those who want to know more about publishing and get a publisher's perspective on this wonderful world of writing, you can tune into that show. And then on July 13th, I will be on with Keisha, and we will be doing the Family Matters show, and we're actually going to be talking about safe dating tips for teens. So that's a really great show for parents, especially parents of teenagers. So tune in on July 13th for that. And thank you, Simon and John, again. It's been great having you guys on the show. We love the show, Simon. It's so informative with all the history. So, and John, you were a great guest. It's full of all kinds of information.
Thank you very much.
So, all right. Well, everybody have a good night, and we will be on again later in the week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Me to the world of ink.